This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. And yes, we have new theme music. More on that later. Also, we'll talk about last night's Tony Awards and revisit my interview with one of the big winners, Bryan Cranston. And director Joe Talbot and actor Jimmy Fails first started making movies together way back in high school. Now their feature film debut, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, had an unusual sales pitch.
I'd say, don't you want to finance a movie between a high school dropout and someone who's never acted in a professional film before? Come on. No, I mean, it was hard. It was hard.
All that coming up on The Frame from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Stick around.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time and era-defining, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
The 73rd Annual Tony Awards were held last night, recognizing the best performances of the past season on Broadway. And although that season was a great one for Broadway's box office, the televised Tonys continue to struggle in the ratings. Still, the award ceremony delivered some big winners, among them Hadestown, which took home a total of 8 trophies. I rang up Jesse Green, the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times, and asked him to explain the musical to those who have yet to see it.
It's a kind of folk rock musical based on ancient Greek myths, reinterpreted for modern days, very heavy on atmospherics, which, you know, that means fog and dark lights on Broadway, and kind of a downtown feeling musical, not a lot of dancing girls and such. And a lot of people are really getting on board with its dark vision.
I want to play a speech by the winner of the directing award for it. It's Rachel Chavkin. Here's what she had to say.
And this is why I wish I wasn't the only woman directing a musical on Broadway this season. There are so many women who are ready to go. There are so many artists of color who are ready to go. And we need to see that racial diversity and gender diversity reflected in our critical establishment too. This is not a pipeline issue. It is a failure of imagination by a field whose job is to imagine the way the world could be.
So I want to talk about that a little bit. She's only the 4th woman ever to win a Tony as the director of a musical, and she was the only woman nominated as a director of any show this year. So what she had to say, it felt like in the room at least, it really resounded. Is she on to something that Broadway really has to figure out?
Absolutely. I mean, even leaving aside the reference to the critical establishment, which I'm not in a position to judge, she is speaking largely about the enormous difference between what we see on Broadway and off-Broadway, where a lot of the most exciting and groundbreaking work is occurring, and a lot more of it is being directed by women and people of color. So she's looking to see that kind of change happen on Broadway. Of course, it takes a lot longer for things to happen on Broadway because the people who control the money are scared.
And what about the winner for Best Play, The Ferryman by Jez Butterworth? It's worth noting that To Kill a Mockingbird was not even nominated in this category.
Well, that was considered by many people to be a snub. I don't usually believe in snubs, but it was so noticeable that I had to wonder whether it might be. There was a lot of trouble associated with getting the play to Broadway. There were lawsuits. The producer is someone who has incredible taste and track record, but is not beloved by everybody in the business.
That would be Scott Rudin, yes.
And some people think that it was because of those reasons that To Kill a Mockingbird was not one of the nominees. But even if it had been, I have a feeling The Ferryman would have won. It was generally considered to be the high price spread this year and pretty much delivered on theatrical values while not alienating the high tone crowd. I personally would have liked to have seen a different play win, a play called What the Constitution Means to Me, a play by a woman and starring a woman, and a play that indeed came from off-Broadway and represents many of the trends we've been talking about. But for those reasons, it was also not very likely to win.
The award for Best Actor in a Play went to Bryan Cranston for playing Howard Beale in Network. And I think the other favorite in that category was Jeff Daniels, who played Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. Cranston won before for playing LBJ in All the Way. Does that feel like a good fit there? Were a lot of people expecting Cranston to win that award?
I certainly did. The thing is, although Jeff Daniels does a terrific job playing Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, I don't think it surprised many people that Bryan Cranston won. The role is much, much flashier. It involves playing both to the theater audience and to a video audience within the theater, because the way this production is done, his character, a newscaster, is always being followed around by cameras at the same time, and to watch him negotiate the two different audiences was quite a thrilling experience. I didn't love the play, but he was fantastic.
I want to hear from someone who isn't nearly as well-known as Bryan Cranston, but whose win, I would say, last night was nevertheless just as important.
This award is for every kid who is watching tonight who has a disability, who has a limitation or a challenge, who has been waiting to see themselves represented in this arena. You are.
That was Ali Stroker. She uses a wheelchair, and she won the Tony for Featured Actress in a Musical for Oklahoma. It feels like that was a very important win, not just for Oklahoma, but for actors with disabilities.
Well, and I would say for a larger group as well, for all actors who represent diverse communities, and you could even say for Broadway in general. The trend, the useful trend, the necessary trend, is opening up the stage, but also the audience, to people of many different kinds. And the great thing about Ali Stroker, aside from that really moving speech she made, is that although she is in a wheelchair and the show, you know, makes use of that, it's not trying to hide her as someone who isn't in a wheelchair. It's using that to the advantage of the development of the character. Nevertheless, I think she would have won even if she weren't in a wheelchair. She's just that good.
So now that the Tonys are behind us, I'm not going to ask you about next year's Tonys, but I want to ask you about the plays and musicals that are resonating with audiences and critics right now, the shows that you're really enjoying and would call people's attention to.
What a lot of us in New York are really excited about are the plays that are bubbling up off Broadway, which we have to believe are soon going to start filtering into Broadway in the way that What the Constitution Means to Me did. A lot of them are plays by black writers that are dealing with really topical, in-the-news subjects, but in form-busting ways that are at the front edge of what theater can be right now. And I think that may be the key to not only keeping those kind of numbers you mentioned on Broadway, but increasing and diversifying them.
Jesse Green is the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times. Jesse, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Hey, thanks, John.
Later on The Frame, we revisit my interview with Tony Award winner Bryan Cranston. But coming up next, the filmmaking duo who left their hearts in San Francisco. There's an idea about storytelling that the more personal the narrative, the more universal it becomes. And it's certainly true of the new film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. It's directed by Joe Talbot and stars Jimmy Fails, and the two have been friends since childhood. The story is loosely based on Fails' own life. He grew up living in the Victorian home his grandfather owned in the Fillmore District of San Francisco. And after the house was lost through foreclosure in the 1990s, Fails bounced from one precarious living situation to another. The Last Black Man in San Francisco premiered at the Sundance Film Festival back in January, and that's where I spoke with Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails about their film. Here's Joe Talbot.
Pretty early on, I feel like Jimmy and I felt like we're probably unusual in our group of friends to be two boys who actually would like just go on walks and talk. I think, you know, even then that was probably sort of unusual.
It just kind of started happening. We would just do it because San Francisco is a walking city, so you walk everywhere, really. So, you know, and we're together a lot. You know, I lived with him for a long time, too. So it was like kind of like a morning ritual sort of thing, just being inspired by all the beautiful homes in Bernal Heights and the scenic city that is San Francisco, you know?
Exactly, yeah. I feel like, you know, we would go on these walks and we would talk about life, but it also is like about sort of like, especially Bernal Heights is this sort of hodgepodgey neighborhood architecturally and even in terms of demographic. It's sort of...
So it's got some Victorian, it's got some kind of newer houses, it's got some rich yuppies, it's got some families that have been there for generations.
Exactly.
Like so much of the city now.
Right. Yeah, Bernal and the Mission both, I think, like, were sort of our stomping grounds growing up. And Jimmy and I are big talkers, you know? I like, that's part of our bond.
Yeah. Jimmy's pointing at Joe saying, you're the talker. I'm the listener. You guys did something together in high school, is that right? Where you guys made a film together?
Yeah. One of the first movies my brother and I made actually starred Jimmy and embarrassingly co-starred me. It was my last time in front of the camera. Jimmy was much more fitting in front of the camera than I was. But that movie, which we've hidden because Jimmy has a flat top he doesn't want anybody to see, and my performance is pretty bad. But we were really lucky, and it got into San Francisco International Film Fest when we were in high school in the youth portion, and that was kind of the first time I think we felt like, you know, wow, maybe we could actually make movies.
So Jimmy, when you and Joe first start talking about this movie, what was the first idea, and how did that idea evolve from that initial conversation to the movie that you ended up making together?
The idea was kind of all over the place at first because it was like, you know, we shot the concept trailer and we kind of wrote something together and put that together, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the full story that we have now, you know, and there was tons of drafts and stuff, but it mainly was just the family story about the house originally. So I think it kind of just evolved from that.
How'd y'all get this? It's Jimmy's. His grandpa built it. He was the first black man in San Francisco.
That's what they call him anyways.
Oh, shit. This that house? Hey, Jimmy used to talk about this spot all the time. But you know how I be in a group home, over exaggerating and trying to be all special. We're lying about this one though, huh, Jimmy?
We're talking with Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails about their movie, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. So Joe, when you were going and talking to people at the get-go, they could be potential investors, they could be people that you wanted to hire. What was your short pitch for this film? How would you even boil this story down to like 15 or 20 seconds?
I'd say, don't you want to finance a movie between a high school dropout and someone who's never acted in a professional film before? Come on. It was hard. It was hard. You know, I think, like Jimmy said, we, you know, this film started under these very sort of informal conversations between friends. And eventually we started sort of cobbling together a crew of friends and family at first who believed in Jimmy's story and rallied behind that and wanted to make it into something. And we shot this very funky concept trailer where I was hanging out of my brother's car as he's driving and I'm filming Jimmy skating back to the house that's sort of, you know, the film is centered on. And we did a much more elaborate version of that sort of in the beginning of the film. And I posted it on my Vimeo, which was hidden at the time. I, like every director, wanted to keep finessing it. It wasn't quite right. And my Vimeo, I didn't pay the annual fee, and so all my videos went public. So I was freaking out and was trying to get the money to hide them again when a local blogger wrote me and said, oh, you know, I really like this piece and I'd love to post it. And so I sort of reluctantly said, oh, sure. And then from there, it started to spread. And, you know, I think it just speaks to Jimmy's story. And we started to discover how unfortunately universal it was, not just in San Francisco, but New York and Los Angeles. And we started getting letters from all over. And sort of through that, you know, beautiful accident, more and more people started writing us who would then eventually go on to become the team that kind of came together to make the film.
Jimmy, there are so many characters in this film. The city of San Francisco is a character, mm-hmm. and there's a Victorian house that's a character. Mm-hmm. What did this house mean to you growing up? And what did you want to make sure that you captured about it in this movie?
Well, the house is sort of my lover in the film, I guess you could say. But for me, growing up, it represented like the only place where my whole family kind of was together. So when we lost the house, like my family's kind of dispersed across the country, like, and no one's really in contact with each other anymore. So it just represented like family and home for me, basically.
And your family lost your house. You were foreclosed on when you were six, is that right?
Yeah, about five or six, yeah.
Joe, at what point did you decide that you were not going to play this character?
Oh.
And that Jimmy's best friend would be played by somebody else and be played by an African American?
To be honest, it never was in the cards. I think, you know, it's natural since Jimmy and I are friends in real life, and the film centers around a friendship, to sort of assume that Mont is, you know, has shades of me. I think all characters in the film probably have some shades of us, you know, as the creators of it. But Mont is very much his own person and came sort of, that was from our imaginations. I think in some ways Jimmy and I are more alike. But, you know, when we were early on sort of talking about this, one of the first things that happened is I met a guy named Prentice Sanders, who has his own sort of incredible connection to San Francisco history. His grandfather was a former police chief, first black police chief in San Francisco, and had been an investigator on the zebra killings in San Francisco. He's sort of a fascinating guy. Anyways, Prentice, who shared the same name with his grandfather, was this great, wonderful, original Bay Area sort of man. And I met him walking down the street, and he sort of became the inspiration for this character. And then when we were sort of gearing up to shoot, we casted Jonathan Majors, who took this inspiration to a whole other level and really created a new character sort of from what had inspired us to create this friendship in the beginning. So what was incredible to me, though, was we would always say this when we were casting sort of fearfully, like, wow, we really have to find someone that Jimmy falls for as a buddy and feels like a real friend. Otherwise, the movie just doesn't work. And, you know, Jimmy has said this before, but when we met Jonathan, he felt like our third brother or something. He just immediately fit in this incredible way, because he wasn't from San Francisco, but he feels so much like a native to us.
When you think about the city and the way it's depicted, Jimmy, your character says in the film, you can't hate San Francisco unless you love it. Do I have that line right?
Yes, you do.
What does that mean to both of you? And I'll start with you, Jimmy, about the city, because the way you shoot in the film is both beautiful and gritty. It is both, you know, your best friend and your worst betrayer. What do all those things mean to you about how you wanted to show the city?
I mean, for me, it's just very simple. In the line, it's like you. I don't think you are able to hate something unless you love it, really. You know, it's like San Francisco has been such an integral part of me as an artist and as a person. So, you know, I have no choice but to love it in that way. But then it's also like, you know, when it's changing rapidly and it doesn't feel the same way as when you were growing up, then, you know, you do kind of have a little, I wouldn't say hate, but, you know, you start to, you know, love it a little less because it doesn't feel like it did.
What about you, Joe?
Yeah, I think, you know, for all its beauty, the people are what makes San Francisco what it is. And as more and more of those people that we grew up with that made the city great can't afford to stay there, many of whom have fought like hell to stay there, you know, that becomes the thing. It's like every conversation you hear in San Francisco these days is about, you know, why you're justifying staying there when it's so hard just to get by. People work multiple jobs. People, you know, because they, you know, there is something about the city that we love. That remains even amidst all these, you know, seismic changes that are happening right now. But as more and more of those people that make the city great are no longer there, you do start to really question, well, then, you know, what is San Francisco?
Joe and Jimmy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Joe Talbot is the director and a co-writer of The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Jimmy Fails stars in the film. It's in theaters now. Coming up, we revisit our talk with Bryan Cranston, who just won the Best Actor Tony for playing Howard Beale in Network.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Hi, this is Bryan Cranston, and you're listening to The Frame on 89.3 KPCC. And now, here's John Horn.
Last night, that guy took home the Tony Award for Lead Actor in a Play. Bryan Cranston won for his portrayal of the news anchor Howard Beale in Network. It's a stage adaptation of the 1976 movie written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs right now, go to the window, open it, stick out your heads and yell. And I want you to yell. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I spoke with Bryan Cranston earlier this year about Network, and we discussed why its story of a veteran TV newsman trying to wake up a generation turned numb by TV is so relevant today. Here's part of that conversation.
When I heard 4 years ago, I had a lunch with Ivo van Hove, our director, in London. And he said he wanted to do this, and I was excited about it because I remembered Network from the 70s when I was in college. And it resonated then. But at the time, I took it, and I think it was intended by Paddy to be satirical, that wouldn't it be strange, wouldn't it be weird if out of this addiction to whatever is the newest technology, this forms our complete and utter addiction to it, and someone can come out of that realm and lead the world. You could be, your mind could be reshaped. What may have been satirical back in the 70s is now what we're living.
The other thing that was important about Howard Beale, and this is what Diana, who is the woman who comes in to promote his rage, says, Howard Beale sat there last night and said what every American feels, that he's tired of all the BS. BS is my word, not the play's word. He's articulating the popular rage.
They're yelling in Atlanta.
Let's go look. Look at them yell. Yell first. You've got to get mad. And when you're mad enough, then we'll figure out what to do with it.
And there's a moment in the play where the audience is encouraged to share in that rage and that anger.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what it's like to hear the audience become as whipped up as they can be whipped up on any given night.
Well, a play is intended to entertain, for sure. But the most important thing that any storyteller, whether you're on stage or film or television, is to elicit an emotional response. I would rather have someone be angry at my performance than bored. If I don't move them to some emotion, I feel like I've failed. So in this case, Paddy and our production team for the theatrical version of it has created an instigation to be able to light a fire under people. And actually, when we get them to say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, it's giving them permission to be angry as a legitimate emotion. And I think our society has been lacking in that. We can accept someone who's irritated or sad or despondent, but anger has not been an embraced emotion for many, many eons. We see someone who's angry, we get away from that. And usually, as a human being, it's appropriate to be tolerant and accepting and embracing of all different beliefs and opinions and religions and lifestyles. It is a lovely thing to do as a human being to be more open. But perhaps right now, in this unprecedented time in our country's history, perhaps now the appropriate emotion is anger, because anger does stimulate activity. I remember in the 60s when anger stimulated a whole movement of anti-war protests and songs and art and plays and movies, and it was a movement that really moved the needle and had an influence on our political leaders. And maybe there's room for that now. Activism is important. The kids down in Parkland are important. The Me Too movement is important. The Women's March is important. Black Lives Matter is important. It's all important, and a lot of that comes out of rage, out of anger. And if placed and directed properly, it can be an incredibly useful tool.
Do you find that useful as an actor? When you are trying to get wound up as the character on stage, do you summon those things that you find frustrating? Does that help you get to where you need to be?
Oh, it certainly does. I've had a challenging childhood, and I've been an actor for 40 years now, and I'm very used to opening up the cavity of my emotions to pull out whatever is necessary for any given scene or character. And I did learn early on that if you can honestly do that and show your vulnerability, even if you're showing a characteristic of your personality that is not favorable, that is not attractive, that audiences will still embrace that because they feel the legitimacy of that.
Brian, thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Good to talk to you.
And a quick note before we go. We hope you noticed our new theme music that you heard at the top of the show and you're hearing it now. It's by LA-based musician Taylor McFerrin, and we're thrilled to have his music on our show. And a quick thanks to the Budos Band, whose music we've used as our theme since we launched The Frame. And that is it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.